And that's the philosophy we want to get the kids away from. Want to get them believing that in Jesus Christ, in my personal relationship with Jesus Christ, stability as a person, esteem as a person, and security as a person is available apart from what's going on in my circumstances. And that means the most terrible kinds of things can be happening, but real joy and real provision for me is still available. Now, we're saying that the way parents respond to certain needs tend to teach that kind of theology, or it tends to reinforce ideas in the world. And we've been talking in terms of the fact that, there's a different strategy that's appropriate for responding to each of these three kinds of needs. And if that that response is accurate, then it's going to result in pushing the kid toward maturity. Not a guarantee that he'll be mature, but at least an increase of probability that he will develop in a healthy kind of way, that she will. But responses that are kind of inaccurate, arbitrary, automatic, non-reflective, they have a tendency of maybe being inappropriate and responding in the wrong way at the wrong time and just resulting in locking the kid more into immaturity. Now look on the first page of your notes. We talked about stability in the midst of unpredictable and a hostile environment being need number one for kids. We talked in terms that when kids experience this kind of stress, the stress of not foreseeable and unavoidable events, that our response needs to be that of providing refuge. We talked about what that involved, and if a parent does that effectively, the child will begin to learn the lesson on a deeper kind of level. The lesson is, I don't have to protect myself. God is my protector. There is someone out protecting me. I don't have to protect myself. And it frees kids from self-protective goals in life. It frees them to be to go out in that 50-volt circle, 100-volt circle, 500-volt circle. It frees them because there's really a belief there's someone else looking out for me. My parents did as long as they could, but I learned from them that you really can trust. You really can trust in people to watch out for you. And now there's not anybody watching out for me. My parents are, their power is limited now, but God's isn't. And it's much easier time for kids to make that jump and to believe in that God is their refuge when they've experienced their parents being a refuge for them. They learn that lesson. And it's not the kind of thing that you can go home and say, okay, let's sit down, I'm going to teach you something tonight. See, in any one of these three lessons, there's nothing that you can teach with one profound conversation or three neat sentences. These are lessons that are learned over time through a variety of experiences as you consistently provide refuge for them. That lesson begins to sink in. It takes a few years. The maturity then is faith, the ability to trust in God, freedom from intimidation, freedom from being controlled by fear, freedom from the goal of I have to protect myself. We notice for the second need, esteem in the midst of his own limitations and inadequacies, that the response on the part of the parents when they're in those kind of stressful events is to demonstrate respect. Not to run in and take over the kid's life and say, you know, I really don't think you're competent to handle this kind of thing. You might fail. That would be terrible. So let me kind of run your life for you. That's the opposite of demonstrating respect. The lesson we want kids to learn here is this lesson. I don't have to prove myself. Life does not depend on me proving myself. It's okay to fail. It's okay to be exposed occasionally as inadequate or not having it all together. It's okay to try things and kind of mess them up. I don't have to constantly prove myself. Kids whose parents, when kids whose parents kind of overreact when their kids fail to prove themselves or do well at something, overreact and say, well, you know, that means that I'm going to have to kind of take your life over for you and kind of run it for you and make all your decisions now. Kids come to believe, wait a minute, boy, that hurts. And if I don't always do the right thing and always proving myself, then I'm going to be put down and ridiculed and I'm going to lose respect. Really, we want kids to come to the conclusion of saying, you know what? My respect, or respect in my parents' eyes, do not depend upon anything I do. There's a sense that I'm justified by them. They look at me and accept me, even with my limitations and weaknesses, and that's the same basis on which God accepts me. We want the kids to learn that the basis upon which esteem comes is justification by Christ. It's what Christ has done for me, and He receives me, and He's given me a work to do that has all kinds of possibilities for impact, and it's not on the basis of the fact that I prove myself. So justification there, and the lesson is I don't have to prove myself. And then there's hope, meaning there's freedom from pressure. There's a sense that I can approach my life without a sense of pressure, that if I'm just faithful in using what God has given me, I don't have to prove anything to anybody, but if I'm just faithful in using what God has given me, all the things I long for as a man or woman, God's going to provide. He'll take care of me. I just don't have to prove myself. There's not that goal. Every week, I tell you, there's nothing that breaks my heart more and brings tears to my eyes than to meet with an adolescent kid of 14, 15, or 16, guys or girls, this disease runs in both of them, where they're just under such fantastic pressure to prove themselves to the world, prove themselves to their mom and their grandparents and their dad and to the friends at school, and not being able to live under that pressure, and as a result, kind of collapsing under it and falling into all kinds of negative kinds of behavior to try to cope. So many kids are under pressure that I've got to prove myself. It's not enough that I'm just mom or dad's son or daughter, but I've got to prove myself. I got to make them proud of me. Yeah, they love me, but I got to make them proud of me. And there's a sense in which the relationship, the richness of the relationship, depends on how well they perform. We've got to give kids a break from that kind of thing and communicate respect and communicate that it really is okay not to always be performing and at your best and those kinds of things. Now, finally, the area of security, while in relationships with selfish people, here we saw the response to this kind of stress is requiring responsibility, not letting them kind of withdraw and give up and quit. And the lesson here is I don't have to control my world. I don't have to control someone else. I really don't have to control someone else. See, oftentimes kids learn that I will pursue anything I can control. If I can control what my coach thinks about me, if I can control what these certain kids at school think about me, if I can control how my parents are going to view me, then that's good. But anywhere where I move that I can't count on how people are going to respond to me, anything that I might do which might hurt relationships with people, I won't do. I've got to control what people think of me. Talking to one young girl recently, and the sentence in her that went through her mind, her controlling belief, the basic assumption at the core of her was this: I can never allow anyone to see anything that's wrong with me. And I would suggest to her that she might want to move this direction. She says, "Oh no, so and so at school see this and they'll think there's something wrong with me." And there was a belief that if anybody ever saw there was anything wrong with this girl, that they would drop her and reject her and move away. So her whole life was based on showing that there's nothing wrong with me. Please, there's nothing wrong with me. And that was the pressure that she lived under. The belief that life depended on controlling everyone's opinion around her so no one will see anything wrong with her. We want to free kids and say, you know what? Life isn't built on capturing other people's opinions. I don't have to have people like me. In fact, it's okay to be lonely. It's okay to be lonely. It's okay not to have friends. I can exist without that. That's not what life is built on. I'm going to choose to do the things I do based on not whether somebody will like me for it or what someone will say about it, but I'm going to choose to do what I do on the basis of what will really serve. Is it ministry? Is it something that will really help God's purposes be broadened? That's the kind of thing I want to control me. And kids are really free to love then. That's the maturity we're looking for here. And that's freedom from manipulation. I don't have to control people. I can just be me. But when kids come to us and say, "Mom, Dad, I can't do this because all the kids at school will say this about me," and our response is, "Boy, that's right. We don't want all the kids at school saying that about you. Well, why don't we try this instead?" "Oh, good. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad. I know you agree with me. I know you think that it's terrible if anybody looks down at me and I can't handle that kind of stuff. Thanks for getting me off the hook." And it's just all reinforced. So often we reinforce in kids, we say, you know, I really do agree with you. You really are too fragile to handle people being down on you, people disagreeing with you. Here, let me figure out a way that we can control other people's opinions. So much of that is taught to kids and reinforced. They really believe that life depends upon not getting anyone upset. Dad, I don't understand why when Grandpa's over, you let him talk to Mom like that. You let him do that. Well, if I said anything to Grandpa, he'd get all mad and it's not worth it. Well, now, wait a minute. You mean your goal is to avoid people from getting upset? That's my goal? Boy, I've got to be careful at school. There's a lot of things I can do to get people upset at me. See, so often kids watch us and they see that we're controlled by that kind of thing, by what people will think of us. Mom, why don't you just tell Dad that he hurts you when he does that? Well, you know how Dad is, and if I tell him that, he'll get mad and he might even leave. Oh, that would be terrible. So let's hide. Life depends on Dad not leaving. So let's all walk around the house like this so Dad won't leave, because if Dad leaves, that's the end of life. You see, we begin to teach kids then that life depends upon controlling others, and it also often leads to deception, hiding stuff. Instead of being honest and saying, I'm going to speak the truth in love to Dad. I love him too much to let him keep being that kind of jerk. I don't think that's a good sentence to say to your kids, but I think that's a good sentence to say in your head. I'm going to speak the truth in love. One of the most powerful things that happened in one family situation I was working with was when the dad decided that he was no longer allowed his brother and his dad, the kid's grandfather, to come over and put the mom down in front of the kids. For years, he allowed that to happen. And the daughter kind of watched this all and kind of learned that, boy, I guess you really got to kind of let people put you down and walk all over you and hurt you like that, because you can't say anything, they'll get mad at you. And when the dad finally saw that immaturity in his life, and he stood up to his brother and his father one time and said, Dad, used his brother's name too, he says, I love you, but I just won't tolerate you talking about my wife that way in the home anymore. Man, all of a sudden there's strength in this girl's life. And Dad survived it. He lived through it. He stood up to Grandpa and lived through it. I guess life doesn't depend on making everybody pleased with you and not getting anybody mad at you. I guess it's okay to speak the truth in love if it's really the best thing to do. I guess that's okay. See, that's the goal of relationships, to speak the truth in love, not to get them to give us something. And that's so important to teach kids that. Freedom from manipulation. Now, as we go back to this area here, and we look at these four areas, let me suggest to you that every one of these three kids that are in quadrants that we want to move, every one of these three kids will at different times require those three different responses. Sometimes we'll need to provide refuge. Sometimes we'll need to demonstrate respect. Other times we'll need to require responsibility. But let me tell you that each one of them kind of needs one of the three of those more than the others. Okay? Now, don't hear me saying that you always use strategy number one with kids that are here. What I'm saying is kids that are here tend to need more of a certain strategy. Kids that fall in this category of being compulsive and compliant because their parents have provided a high-low home environment, these kids tend to need the response of demonstrating respect more than the other two. That one tends to be the stronger need for them. They need to sense some sense of autonomy that I really can make life work apart from Mom or Dad telling me what to do. I really can make my own decisions, and if I fail, that's not the end of life. I can make life on my own. I can be autonomous from Mom and Dad and authorities. Remember, what this kid believes is that life depends on pleasing others or meeting the expectations of others. And so this kid needs to demonstrate respect. This kid, by the way, when I was teaching some college classes and I would give an assignment that was obviously kind of vague, it would drive this kind of kid nuts, because he wasn't sure what I expected. So he'd come to me and say, can you give me more details on the assignment? No. Well, I mean, exactly what are you looking for? I don't know. Just do what you want to do. Do what you think is good. And this kid panics. I can't do that. Life depends on meeting the expectations of others. What are your expectations so I can meet them? And these parents need to back off, provide less expectations. The kid comes, I don't know what to do. Two or three guys have asked me out. I don't know which one to go with. Which one do you think I ought to go with, Mom? I don't know. Well, life depends on picking the right one. No, it doesn't. You just decide. Who do you like the best? I trust your judgment. I think you can do it. Providing respect. These kind of kids need to be given less expectation and a whole lot more freedom to fail and be autonomous. What are you going to get involved in school this year, Sally? Well, I was thinking I would go out for cheerleading, and I'd be on the basketball team, and I was thinking about debate team, and I wanted to run for student council too, and I'm hoping I'll be elected to homecoming court. See that kid? That kid is obsessed with getting under expectations. Adult structure. Life depends on it. And these kids just, they're obsessed with taking on more and more responsibility. The more expectations they can get under, the more promise there is of approval. And maybe the best thing to say to that kid is, you know what? This year, I just want you to have more free time to kind of think and do what Sally wants to do. You're kind of limited to two activities this year. You pick which two. I just want you to have a whole lot more time to just be Sally. I don't want so many structured kinds of things in your life. And I think that's a good limitation to give to this kind of kid, which requires them to be more on their own, not always under the authority and structure of some activity. Autonomy is what they need. Second of all, this kind of kid here tends to be the kind of kid that we need to provide refuge for more. That is the dominant response this kid needs. Providing refuge. This kid has experienced very little refuge, and really his need is to experience the fact that he can really depend or count on adults. He can really count on being there. This kid really believes that no adult has ever been there for him, and so life depends upon escaping adult authority. Life depends on escaping others, but especially adult authority, is what this kid believes. And this kid needs to experience the fact that mom and dad can really be counted on. When mom and dad say, no, you're not allowed to go to that, they can really be counted on to come through with consequences. And mom and dad can really start to be counted on to be involved in my life and be around more. They said they were sorry, and that, you know, when I got arrested for shoplifting and I came home, they said, son, you know, we have to take some of the responsibility for that too, because we haven't been around much lately. And we're going to change that. This is our problem, not just your problem. And our family's all going to radically work on this, because we really believe that part of the problem has been the fact that we just haven't been around enough for you, son. Now, you chose to shoplift, and you're going to have to pay some consequences for that. But so are we, because we feel like we just haven't been around enough for you. So we want you to forgive us, son. And now he can really start counting on mom and dad, even though dad gives up a promotion, to move to a lower job so he doesn't have to spend 65 hours a week at the office. He can only spend 40 now, or 45, because he wants to be around more. He can really start counting on dad. It's a radical change that's happened here. This kid needs refuge, and it's impossible to provide refuge for your kid without your presence being there. Kids need your presence in order to have refuge. Now, the major dominant need up here for this kid is to experience what it means to be competent. And so this kid, this is much more the strategy of requiring responsibility for this kid. See, this kid's goal is, whatever the expectations are, I'm going to change them. I can change adult authority. That's my goal. You announce a rule, and my goal is to be the exception to the rule. I'm going to control others. And this kid can always get under or around or get you to bend or change or modify your requirements for him. And this kid really needs for you to say, no, I really think that you're confident enough to handle it. But I can't. There's no way I can get that done by Monday. Oh, I think you can. The responsibility stands, and if you choose not to do it, then there'll be a consequence, and the consequence will be this. But Mom, don't you understand? Dad, don't you understand? I can't. Here's all the reasons for it. I think he can. This kid needs to be really kind of held to his responsibilities and learn that he can't manipulate you and get it out, get you to change on that. Now, I warn you that this kind of kid will often resort to suicide threats when all else fails. Okay, then I'll just go kill myself if I can't go this week. If you don't let me go, I'll just go up and kill myself. Now, let me tell you that when a kid makes a suicide threat, you always want to take it seriously. And there's always a way to respond that will let him know that you take the threat seriously, but still you don't give him his way. You see? You don't allow a suicide threat to control you. You don't allow a suicide threat to get him out from under responsibility. I tell you, of the two kinds of kids, the kid you have to worry about the most that makes a suicide threat is this kind of kid. The compliant compulsive kid. See, this kid hates disapproval, and there's no way he wants to be around on the other side of a suicide attempt. And this kid is usually perfectionistic, and so whatever he does well. He's afraid of failure. And so if this kid attempts to take his own life, he's going to usually be successful. This kind of kid is often using suicide threats as a strategy to control his parents. It's usually not accompanied by the same degree of depression. It's normally a kind of a sudden thing when they can't get their way. This kind of kid, it's more of a slow, chronic decline into depression that lasts for several days or several weeks, and there's a despondency, and there's a lack of activity, and there's a real despair that begins to be sensed. And watch out for this kid when he goes that direction, begins to talk about suicide, because this kid usually does whatever he attempts well. This kid will normally take some pills, but then let you know he took them. He doesn't really want to die. All he wanted to do is to cause you some hassle so that you let him have his way. Now, even these kind of kids can be accidentally successful. And that's why we always want to take suicide attempts seriously. And when a kid threatens suicide, we need to let him know that if he's really serious at that and he's not willing to make a commitment that he won't do that, then you'll need to get him some help or some protection. That's almost a whole topic in itself. But that's the kind of thing that maybe you want to call immediately on for some counsel from someone else and say, I'm not sure how to respond and how to do. But for one thing is, we can't allow a child learn that he can control the household through a suicide attempt. We keep requiring responsibility. We keep requiring it. Now, these are the dominant approaches as kids follow these different quadrants. And by the way, there's no one that is a pure high-high. You see, we all have a tendency of allowing our households at times to fall into one of these three, which gives us plenty of room to work, plenty of things to do. Now, let's move to our next topic. And that topic is one of responding to adolescent reasoning. Responding in a way that helps your teen be controlled by truth in his inner purposes. Truth in his inner purposes. David talked about that. That was his prayer. His prayer was that he'd be controlled by truth in the innermost man. That was his real desire. And that should be our desire for our kids. Now, there's a certain strategy for this. And let me say this, that there's a lot we can do leading up to adolescence to soften kids, to help them in their reasoning abilities, to kind of soften them in their reasoning ability, make the truth, or earn for the truth more of a hearing, make them a little bit more receptive to the truth as they move into adolescence. And that's our first topic there, the softening process. How to make kids more receptive to the truth is softening them. Softening them. Now, Paul is one that was real good at softening people and making them more receptive to truth before he really even really started teaching often. But there's some things that we see here in Timothy that was done early on that softened him so that as he moved into his early adult years, he was more prepared to receive the truth and to live obediently according to it. Turn with me to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And Paul here is calling Timothy to the same kind of life that he had lived or was in the process of living out. He was calling Timothy to the same kind of life. That's powerful, by the way. That's powerful when you're calling your kids to the same kind of life as you're living. What is not powerful is to call them to a life that you're not living. Kids, here's what I desire for you. Now, I've been too weak to live that way, but I want you to be there. See, that's tough. I found that to take a kid out and live with him 10 or 12 weeks, going door to door witnessing, going door to door and seeing people accept Christ and making sure he's in the Word every day, and I did that for 6 summers. I found that something that had much more impact on a kid's enduring life patterns than having him disciplined for a full 10 weeks was having him stay home instead and watch his parents demonstrate those same things. What I'm saying is I found that it has more impact in the long run on a kid than to take him out and help him lead 10 kids to Christ himself. What has more enduring impact on making him a soul winner is if he would have stayed home and watched his parents lead one person to Christ. His tendencies, as he watches his parents, that will have much more impact. That's why we've really got to be careful. We can keep spending so much money in youth ministry and realize that for a whole lot less money, we could work with the parents and train the parents and have more impact in the long run on the kids. And that doesn't mean that we're ready to dismantle our youth ministry at the chapel. If anything, we're beefing it up. Because there's lots of parents of those kids we don't have access to. So we've got to work just with the kids. But boy, the kids whose parents we have access to, how much more impact can we have on those kids' life if those parents are models? Models of what we're aiming at together to bring the kids to. And that's what we see here from Paul. He says in verse 10, he's talking to Timothy, who was his son in the faith. Paul was really his father in so many ways. He says, "You, however, know all about my teaching. You know all about my way of life. You know my inner purposes. You know about my inner character, faith, patience, love, endurance. You know about my external situations of pain, persecution, sufferings. You knew what kinds of things happened to me in Antioch and Iconium and Lystra. You know about the persecutions I endured. And you also know about how the Lord rescued me from all of them. In fact, everyone who wants to live godly in Christ Jesus will have to endure 900,000 volt shocks. They will be persecuted. This is a high voltage type of lifestyle. Why? Because evil men and imposters will just continue to get worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. That's why. But as for you, verse 14, continue in what you have learned and have become convinced of. Why? Well, it's because you know from those whom you learned it, and how from infancy you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. Now he's making an appeal to Timothy to follow him in his lifestyle. Come on out here in the high voltage and live with me. Just yesterday I was talking to a teenager and I said, come on out, come on out. She had moved in the 25-volt circle and built walls up. And was absolutely miserable within those walls. And her soul was crying out through some bulimic-type behavior, I want more, but I'm too fragile. I can't move outside the 25-volt circle. I can't afford to ever do anything to ruffle anybody's feathers. I can't do anything to hurt anybody. And so she had built this wall up and had decided that any behavior that risked more than 25 volts was non-acceptable. And so she was in there demanding that she have what she wants without going outside the circle. I want love. I want relationships. I want to do something important with my life, but I refuse to go outside the 25-volt circle. And since I'm not getting it, I'm depressed. And her soul would cry out for something, and that was the pressure behind the bulimia. That was the pressure. Obedience for her meant to walk outside the 25-volt circle. And you know what? In the last few weeks, I've seen her parents begin to do that for the first time. And she's seeing them now. She's seeing their example. She's seeing them walk out and take risks with each other, addressing problems in their marriage they haven't addressed for a long time, addressing problems with the neighbors they haven't addressed. And she's starting to say, you know what? I don't have to sit here and cry like I can't have what I want. I can really take hold of life. I can really go out and build relationships. I can really go out and make something of my life for the Lord. I don't have to sit here and cry because it's not happening. There's some real freedom happening, and it's because there was a model there that was starting to go outside the 25-volt circle. The kids who have been taught by their parents that you're really too fragile and you can't handle high voltage, you stay here because the goal of life is to be comfortable. That's the goal of life. The goal of life is to be comfortable. Don't ever do anything that's going to make life uncomfortable. Come on. And so kids are locked in. As they get older, they can't get what they want. They don't feel any sense of significance sitting in a 25-volt circle. You can't really make any deep relationships sitting inside a 25-volt circle. The kids' souls begin to cry out, but they learn from their folks they can't take more than 25 volts. And so they're sitting there locked in. And it's so good when parents begin to demonstrate, begin to take them out with their own life and say, you live like I did. You know all about my life. You know all about my love, my purposes. You know how I've suffered persecution for the cause of Christ. You know how I'm willing to face 500-volt circles for you or 500-volt shocks for you. Come on along. And the reason I want you to do it is because you've known me and you've known the Scriptures. And that's what we want to say, going back to your notes, are some of the prerequisites here to the softening process. The pre-establishment of a personal relationship with parents who model the truth. Hopefully that can happen before you reach adolescence. And if it hasn't happened, if there isn't a good relationship yet, play catch up. Go back and work on it. I noticed that Josh McDowell just published his research digest. This has been a couple years in the making, really researching what is the problem behind teenage promiscuity. And there's tons of raw data in here. And here's the summary of one study. Over half of the adolescents in the adolescent parent study of church parents and their kids, over half of them spend less than 30 minutes a day with their fathers, that's the kids, and 44% spend less than 30 minutes with their mothers. That's the same amount of time parents take for watching the news on TV. Even more alarming, one-fourth of the ninth graders in this study spend less than 5 minutes a day alone with father to talk, play, or just be together. No doubt this neglect is one reason why 46% of the fathers in this study admit that they worry about how their children feels about them. Relationships. And it's really tough to start to expect that when we begin to reason with our kids that there's going to be a receptivity to what we have to say if there's not a pre-established relationship. And Paul is saying, you start living like me. Go for it. Don't you start going like those evil imposters. You start living like me because you've known me. You know me. And you know that what I'm saying is really genuine. You know me. And so building that relationship up is kind of a prerequisite to being able to reason with your kids once they get into adolescence. And it is possible to play catch-up. You got kids that are presently adolescents and you kind of neglected that relationship. There's a lot of things you can do to go back and start focusing on it. Second of all, is a pre-familiarity with the truth through years of personal instruction by consistent models. It is so important that while our kids are in 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th grade, that we just pack their heads full of Bible stories. We pack their heads full of Bible doctrine. We pack their heads full of biblical principles. Because they're just not going to sit there and listen that much during adolescence. So we want to build up a reservoir in their brain of biblical data so that in the midst of a crisis in adolescence, we can recall their memory. We can ask them to recall scriptures they previously learned. Not too many adolescents are going to memorize scripture, but a lot of 4th, 5th, and 6th graders are going to do it. And that's a very important aspect of working with pre-adolescents is getting that biblical data in their head. 1st, 2nd graders aren't that interested. You know, it's hard to hold their attention. But 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th graders, that's the time to sit down and systematically we begin to teach them things. Take them through courses. Take them through books. Teach them all the stuff you want them to know before they get to be teenagers. Give them a course on sexuality. Give them a course on music and the kind of music and the stuff. They're very receptive at that age, and you can get a lot of data in their brains. And it'll be stuff you can call upon later then in adolescence. But to start in adolescence, that's tough. But we still have to try. And finally, the pre-establishment of household boundaries that represent God's truth. It's important that we have boundaries, standards that we live by in our household that are closely as possible represent God's moral boundaries. Not a bunch of preferences from mom and dad, but really moral boundaries. I don't understand, why can't I watch whatever television show? Well, son, it's because of this. We thought through the biblical boundaries or what we ought to watch. And that show we've watched once, if you call, and here's the things we saw in it. We really believe that's outside the boundaries of what God really wants us to watch. Oh, Well, then why do you guys watch it after I go to bed? Well, son, you've got a good point, and we're going to stop that. That's not right. It's not right. You know, you can do that when kids are younger. You can put them to bed and watch stuff. But once they get to be teenagers, you cannot partake of entertainment that they cannot partake of. You guys, you have to have the same standards all across because they see themselves already as adults. The pre-establishment of household boundaries. Now, that's a softening process, and hopefully as they're soft, we can begin to shape them now during adolescence. And I just want to say again, I've said it to you before, that I really see the period of adolescence as a gift from God. It's literally we get a second chance, a second crack at anything we missed our first time around. Anything you missed during childhood, you don't have to wonder, oh, I wonder what I'm missing. What have I overlooked? Anything you overlook during their childhood, it comes back and slaps you in the face during adolescence. You get a second crack at it. You get an opportunity to work on it. And I believe that's a real gift from God, and we need to know how to reason with kids. Now, we're going to talk in terms of responding to requests, to questions, to objections, to decisions. Let's look at requests first. We're going to suggest to you that when you're responding to requests, that you make it your initial goal to understand the request. To understand the request. Now, understand this, that many, many times the initial request will strike a chord of fear in your heart. Mom, Dad, since I'm 13 now, I like to start riding a motorcycle to school. What do you think? You know, oftentimes, the parents' fear is ballooned by request, and it's so easy then to be controlled by that fear and say, there's no way in the world that you're, you know, whatever. But we need to stop and say, well, now let me understand what you're asking. Because sometimes we misunderstand initially, and at least by listening to the child and hearing them out, we are demonstrating respect. And it's good to listen to them and say, well, now let me see if I understand. What you're asking is da 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 da. Yeah, that's what I'm asking. You know, now they think they've got, you know, they got you following because it's such a different response. Usually, you know, Dad is a no dad. And he says no before it's even out of my mouth. He's listening this time. It must mean that he's going to let me do it. You know, we don't want to pick kids up and then drop them. So at first, they're not going to know how to, how to react to you. But you begin by saying, you know, help me. Now let me understand this. You want to do this and this and this. And now, why is this so important to you? This is kind of a weird request. You know, this is something that you know that we don't allow here at the house. Why would you come and ask me now? What's different now than 3 months ago when I said no? Those are all good questions, so you can understand the context and where the request is coming from. Second of all, delay your response if necessary in order to reflect. Delay if necessary or if possible. Well, you say, boy, you know, that one's going to take some thought, and I want to talk to your mom about it, and I want to talk to your dad about it, so let me get back to you on it, okay? Delay the response when necessary. Now, if it's something that's absolutely, you know there's no way you'd ever consider it, you might say, no, I just don't, I can't imagine any situation I'd let you do that in. No, the answer is no. But, you know, and listen to their appeals. Listen to their appeals. That we get to objections next on that. Distinguish between the acceptability of the request and the teen's intention in making it. That's very important. And that, again, goes below the waterline. See, the request is above the waterline. The intention is below the waterline. And you want to listen for the intention underneath the request. What is it the child is really trying to accomplish by asking for this privilege or asking this particular activity, asking for it? What are they trying to accomplish? And, you know, it can fall into four categories then. The request can be acceptable, and the intention itself can be acceptable, and that's where you have the fun of just granting the request. Just grant it. But if you find that the request is not acceptable, but underneath that, there seems to be a good intention. They want to help somebody, they want to give, there's just something that sounds good about the intention, but the particular request you cannot fulfill. In that case, you want to affirm the intention, and you want to suggest some kind of creative alternative. And I think it's a good idea as you're listening to them and trying to determine what their intention is to say, I like the basic idea. I like what you're trying to accomplish, but I'm not sure that's the best way to do it. I've got some problems with that. Have you thought about this instead? And interact with your child and see if you can't come up with a creative alternative that way for something that they want to do. Now, if it comes down here and the request is acceptable, but you sense the tension intention underneath it is not good, like the kid comes down after a fight and says, "Can I go spend the night with my friend?" And you can't see any reason why they can't go. You know, it's a good friend. You can't see any reason why. But the intention is to punish mom and dad. The intention is to go and pout. And you sense that. That's at the point to say, well, you know, I really don't have any problem with you going over to Bill's house to spend the night. But I think I have some problem with why you're going. I sense that you're going over there to punish mom and dad, and you just want to kind of pout a while and instead of stay here and work things out. Now, son, I don't think it's a good idea that you go over to Bill's under these circumstances. I'd rather see you stay here and work things out with us. We got some areas we disagree in. And stay here and work them out and then go over to Bill's later or another time. But I'm going to leave the decision up to you. So that's the point where you can permit the request, but you bring the intention up to them and mention to them that it bothers you. You see? So you can permit the request, but you do get to question the intention. But if it falls in this category, where it's the request is not acceptable, and you sense the intention under it is not acceptable, then there's no question that you refuse the request. But not just the request, you also draw attention to the intention and say, you know, son, the only problem I've got with what you're asking is not the fact that you're asking to go to that kind of concert. I really believe that music is out of bounds for you. But also, son, I sense the spirit in which you're asking is wrong. I sense that you're coming and saying, "You better let me go or else." And son, even if the concert was an acceptable concert to go to, I don't think I'd let you go with that attitude. And that, let's talk about what you're so angry about. "Oh, you never let me do anything." What are some of the things you think we're holding you back from? Talk about it. You see, it's good you get kids to express anger directly to you. Even though you can't give in, let them express the anger to you. And we'll get to that in a second. By the way, you know, when you're using this thing of understanding their intention, you can use all those skills that we taught way back when we talked about how to get involvement or understanding. Listening underneath words, giving door openers, asking the right kinds of questions. All of those kinds of things are the skills you use to get underneath the question and determine the intention. And almost any time you sense there's a request, if you listen enough underneath the waterline, the behavior seems to take on some direction. There's something they're really wanting to accomplish with that request. And that gives you an idea of what the intention is. What is their direction? What's the kid trying to accomplish with this? Are they trying to buy friendship? Are they trying to just get in with this crowd? Are they sensing that they need to do this in order to keep up with their brother or sister? What's going on? What's behind the intention? And then I can respond. And we're talking about responding in an uncompromising way. It means that I respond to both the outer request and the intention. That's what God does. And it takes some time to learn that. Now let's go on to responding to questions. If we had time, we could look at Deuteronomy 6. And in Deuteronomy 6, Moses says to parents, you ought to live the kind of life that intrigues your kids and provokes questions. In Deuteronomy 6, Moses says, when you get to the land, do this and this and do these three weird things so that when your kids see them, they say, "Mom, Dad, that's weird. Why do you do that?" Then you have a chance to talk to them about it. So you ought to be living the kind of life that provokes questions in your kids. Why in the world did we go to church? Nobody else I know goes to church. Why do we go to church? Well, that's a good question. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what role church has in our lives. We ought to be living the kind of life that provokes questions. Point A there. Welcome questions as opportunities to explore and shape your adolescent's thinking. Don't look at questions as an interference or automatically an expression of rebellion. But welcome questions because it gives you an opportunity to shape your kid's reasoning. Anything that engages the two of you intellectually is gold. It's a great opportunity. Distinguish between reasonable and unreasonable questions. And again, that's determined by the team's purpose in asking them. A reasonable question is an honest request for information. An unreasonable question is a dishonest statement of rebellion or trying to argue or trying to win their point or trying to get you to change. And as a child asks you the question, give them as much of the benefit of the doubt as you can that it's a reasonable question. No, son, we decided that you really can't go to this. But why not? I don't understand why. You're talking to your daughter and say, it's really time to clean the house. We're going to work on cleaning the house today. We want your bed. Why do I have to clean my room? Now, is that reasonable or unreasonable? My initial response wants to be to assume that all my kids' questions are reasonable, knowing that some of them aren't. So every question I can meet with giving information, that just gives me more opportunity to influence my kids. It gives me more chance to feed them data. So accept questions as reasonable unless they begin to persist, and it's obvious now their purpose is to wear you down, to punish you, to cause pain, to disrupt the family. At that point, then, there's a different response. You don't respond with information. Now, point C. Reasonable questions should be answered by induction whenever possible. Induction. Now, induction is nothing more than inducing someone with data. Inducing someone with reasons why they ought to do it this way. Induction. God in His Word gives us boundaries, but the boundaries He could almost fit in one chapter. It's the inducement to keep the boundaries that takes the 66 books. See, God never says, just do it. He goes to great length explaining why it's the best thing for us to do it. He induces us to obedience. When we say, God, I understand, why in the world, why can't I have sex before marriage? Well, God gives 30 or 40 reasons in Scripture why it's not a good idea. He induces us to obedience. And we're not real good at, as parents, normally doing that with kids, giving them reasons. Especially scriptural reasons for things. But why can't I stay out after 11 o'clock? I can't. Because I'm your parent. And if I say you're going to be an 11, you're going to be an 11. Okay, now that might be a response to an unreasonable request, unreasonable question, but I want to first treat that question as much as I can as reasonable. Okay, let's sit down and talk about why we've got curfews and why 11 o'clock is a concern to your mom and I. Let's sit down and talk about it. Gives me a chance to get some data in this kid's head. Gives me a chance to teach. Gives me a chance to talk. So I want to give them as much as possible scriptural inducements. Induce them. Last year, I was meeting with a breakaway group, and I asked the kids, okay, what I want right now, and I had a piece of paper, and I said, here, I want you to call out all the reasons why your parents have told you you shouldn't have sex before marriage. Call them out. All the reasons your parents have given you. No, go ahead, call them out. And the whole breakaway group could not come up with one reason they've heard from any of their parents. I'm sure that now it's because they have wax in their ears or they're deaf. But it's interesting that a whole group of 25 kids could not come up with one reason they had heard from their parents of why they shouldn't have sex before marriage. That's dangerous. We ought to be inducing our kids to moral purity all over the place. Or be posting verses, buying them posters, get the reasons out there, get the scriptural data out there. Give them an idea. And I made that a hobby. So far I found 37 reasons why kids shouldn't have sex before marriage. And always when I mention that, a parent comes up afterwards and asks me, can I have those? And I say, no. Because half the fun is digging them out yourself. Half the fun is digging them out yourself. Inducement. Unreasonable questions should be answered with door-opening responses that invite the adolescent to divulge the hidden purposes for asking his questions. Son, I got a feeling you keep asking me that question, and you really don't want an answer to that question. You want to tell me something, don't you? Yeah, I want to tell you something. I think it's unfair. Tell me more. Talk. And the more we can get the kids talking and getting their feelings and getting their anger out, the better off we're going to be with them. So a door opener is what you give to a unreasonable question, not a door closer. That's it? No more. I don't even want to hear it anymore. Now, that might be something way, way down the road to use, you see. But most of the time, I want to respond to even unreasonable questions with door openers, because it just gives me more time to teach. It gives me more chance to talk. And that's like gold with kids. Now, strategy three here, responding to objections. Never make it your goal to get your adolescent to agree with you or to win an argument with him. You don't have to prove you're right. Don't make it your goal not only to get them to agree with you, but don't even get it your goal to say they understand you. Now, do you understand? No. Do you see? There's a sense in which that's a goal you don't have 100% control over. So you don't want to make it your goal to win an argument, to prove that you're right, to get them to say they agree or even understand. Instead, when your adolescent objects, make it your goal to understand his objection and to clarify your own position. That's my goal, to clarify my position. Is that a goal I have 100% control over? Yes. I can't make him understand if he doesn't want to understand, but I can make it my goal to clarify my position. Son, let me go back over this for you and tell you why this is my decision. Let me go over it with you again. Okay? Now let me go over it again with you. And after I've clarified my position, I don't have to get him to say he agrees with it. I don't even have to get him to say that he understands it. But if I think there's still reasonable questions, there's a reasonable ignorance, I keep clarifying my position. Once I come to the conclusion that this kid doesn't need clarification anymore, this is unreasonable questions, that's at the point where I give door openers and say, I don't think, son, you're interested in reasons for that, really, are you? I really think there's something more going on. I think you keep asking the question because I think you want me to change my mind. Why don't you just come out and tell me why you think I ought to change my mind? I want to hear the reasons. And turn it around and let them talk it. Let them give it to you. Doesn't mean you'll change your position, but at least you're understanding them. You're paying respect. Always encourage your adolescent to express objections, even when they are accompanied by negative or hostile feelings. Now, there's a good chapter in Ross Campbell's book that has this anger ladder in it. And I've changed that anger ladder a little bit. Maybe I'll print this up for you because there's some things I don't like about his anger ladder. But I like my anger ladder better, although I borrowed the idea of an anger ladder from him. But the idea is this, is that you teach kids that there are certain ways that are always acceptable. There's certain things you always do when you're angry. There are things you never do. But then there are some other things that you consider. There's some things that are usually negative, but there are other things that are usually positive. And you begin to teach your kid that there are certain things that they can do with their anger. That is good, there are certain things that are bad. And almost always, we will accept a sense of direct expression from our kid. Now, we won't allow them to cuss at us or hit us or throw things, but we will allow them to tell us, we'll allow them in a controlled way, always to tell us how they feel, unless it's in front of somebody that shouldn't be hearing our family business. And then I'll say, son, I want to hear what you had to say. When we get home, let's sit down and you go over it with me. I know you're really angry with me right now, but we can't talk right now. But I want to hear it from you as soon as we get home. Now, Ross Campbell not only talks about the fact that kids got an emotional tank that we got to keep full, but he says they have an anger tank that we got to keep empty. You see? There's two tanks. Keeping the emotional tank full, the anger tank empty. And if you got a kid who has a full anger tank, he just doesn't have legitimate ways to express his anger, then it's going to come out in passive-aggressive behavior. Turning the stereo up. Stealing, cheating, not doing, almost always, a deliberate attempt to do poor on homework is a passive-aggressive expression of anger toward parents. Almost always. A deliberate goal to sabotage homework or sabotage grades is almost always an attempt on the part of them to express anger indirectly to their parents. They can't express it directly. Dad blows up. I can't ever talk to Dad. If I say, Dad, I disagree, he says, I'm your father and that's the way you're going to do it. I just wish once I could just tell Dad how I feel, but Dad's too weak to handle it. It's so much better to sit down and say, son, Let's get it out. Pour it out. Come on, let me hear it. Anything you can get out directly to you is so much better because it's like poison to the system. It's poison. That anger that stays in there, it just festers and it results in passive-aggressive behavior that's going to get him in trouble somewhere. But if you can get it directly out, get him to throw it up right here with you. Come on, get it out. Let's hear it. Come on, talk. I want to hear. I care about how you feel. Come on. Don't spit at me, but talk to me. Come on. I want it out. That kind of thing, then, really keeps the anger tank empty and really reduces the probability of the kid doing things indirectly to hurt you or get back at you or to express anger.